Hello. Hi, everyone. I'm Diana Murphy, the publisher of Metropolis Books, which is the publisher of Emily's book, Design Revolution, 100 Products That Empower People. And I'm really proud and delighted to be able to introduce Emily to you all. I've known her for about 4 years now, and we made the book together, and I've watched her organization, Project H, grow and transform, and I think you're really going to be interested to hear her story. We made the book together and then started talking about, well, how should we launch this book? And, you know, we're thinking panel event or, you know, she can give a talk. And she went off and, like, developed this whole road show. She basically took her thing on the road for 4 months to design schools around the country, colleges, and then high schools as well, and pretty much spent 4 months just traveling around the country talking about how design can improve communities and respond to very basic but essential needs. And she's continued along this trajectory, and she's along the way spoken at TED. She's been on the Colbert Report. She's received grants from Adobe and the NEA, and she's just really been building her organization, and I just continue to admire her more than I can even say. She most recently, after doing the roadshow, she decided it was time to kind of hunker down, and she started teaching a design course in a high school in Bertie County, North Carolina, which is the poorest county in the state, rural, really had a rough couple of years, the community, in terms of tornado. Was there a flood, Emily, too, I think? Two floods. Lots of difficulties, but she persevered, and she's finishing out her second year there and is very eager to tell you her story. So with that, I introduce Emily Pilloton. And I have to say, she's going to be signing copies of her book right after her talk right outside, so stick around.
Hello. Thank you guys all for coming. I know the sun finally came out, and so we all probably want to be outside, so appreciate you being here. And thank you, Diana, for the intro. I was actually asked to find someone to do my intro, and Diana was the perfect person because we realized today that she has known me and my organization basically since day one. And I want to just tell you a story today. I've realize that I'm not very good at giving presentations that try to impart wisdom or teach anything overt. So sometimes I think the best thing we can do is just tell stories of projects and initiatives and failures and challenges. And so that's what I'm going to do today. And it's a story of A, how I went from being a working designer to being a high school shop teacher in the deep south. And then more importantly, about 13 of my students who changed the face of their hometown over the course of 12 months. So, you know, these three words, this is the title of my talk, and I think these three things are really central to the story and maybe are sort of the moral of the story. So to jump to the moral of the story, you know, I really believe in design. I was trained as a designer, but I think that design has become so many different things in the past couple years in particular. So I'm particularly interested in design as a form of capital and as a way to build social and economic value in communities that probably haven't looked to design as a resource before. And build, I know that, you know, everyone in this room is probably very tech savvy. And I think that when we hear the word technology, we think technology equals high tech. But I want to make the case that there is something to be said for really honest, dirty, analog solutions that are built physically with your hands. And then transform in that, you know, yes, I'm trained as a designer, but somehow I became a high school teacher. And that we, in order to have the kind of social impact that we're all talking about, we have to be able to take on things that are maybe outside of our job description or that our training maybe hasn't trained us for. And to really be a citizen first and foremost before we go out and put on our designer or whatever profession that we're in, before we put on those hats, we need to be good citizens. So as Diana said, I started this nonprofit called Project H in January of 2008. And at the time, I was living with my parents and had, like, no money and also no business plan. But I had come out of graduate school and a couple years of working in the profession, both in architecture and then also as a furniture designer, and just feeling pretty disconnected from all the reasons I first got into design. And I think we're hearing this from a lot of designers these days, at least I know I am, that there's a real disconnection between working in a traditional design trajectory and addressing problems that we all are talking about and feel the need to find solutions to. So I set up Project H with this very broad, non-business plan to try to figure out how to do the kind of design work that I wanted to be doing, and ideally to give other designers that felt the same way opportunities to do that type of work as well. So from the beginning, this started really as an advocacy organization to try to build interest around this kind of work, to bring opportunities to designers that wanted to do this type of work. And so some of our initial projects were very small, local interventions that I wasn't even, you know, working as a designer so much as an organizer of other groups of designers in cities around the world. So this was a sterile and modular storage system that a team in Mexico City did for a children's hospital ward. And then a DIY furniture project for an elementary school outside of Mexico City. And then this is actually here in Austin, and we had a really wonderful team of designers who are from Mixer Design Group, and I think maybe one of them is even here right now. There's Chris. I should have him talk about this, but this is a redesign of these spaces that were referred to as quiet rooms, and they were places where they would essentially put children when they are misbehaving or having acute emotional reactions and close the door and sort of let them work it out. And so the renovation and the redesign of these spaces are now more therapeutic. They're more, the kids want to be in them now. They actually request to be in these rooms instead of them being sort of solitary confinement in a way. I don't want to make that analogy, but definitely more in tune with the kids' needs. And then this was a project that I got to work on. This is the Learning Landscape, educational playground system that I developed with a school in Uganda when I was over there for about 6 weeks. It's a really simple, you can build this thing for free if you can find tires. But essentially we wrote this series of games so that kids can learn algebra or foreign language translations or grammar or really any core subject through gameplay instead of being in a classroom. And then as Diana mentioned, I wrote this book and got to sort of curate a collection of the things that had been done in this field so far. In my mind, kind of as a benchmark for what was going on and maybe how we could talk about continually doing better. And then the infamous roadshow, this is like a whole other lecture here, but 35 schools in 75 days. We built out this old Airstream. My partner Matt Miller and I lived in basically from the pink stripe to the back was our living quarters and the rest of it was exhibition space. So lecture series, exhibition, and just cross-country chaos. But it was a wonderful sort of bookend to what we had started in the field of advocacy and getting people talking about this type of work and interested in it. So this is sort of Project H 1.0, where we were in a position of being advocates. We had a wonderful community of support around the idea of socially oriented design work. And then what happened is, this was all really wonderful, but we also felt like, my partner Matt and I felt that we needed to also be practitioners, that we could only be advocates for so long before we wanted to and frankly needed to be doing some of this work and hopefully setting examples and models that we could all learn from. So around the time, right when I got back from Uganda with the Learning Landscape project, I got an email from this guy. This is like February 2009, and this is Dr. Chip Zollinger. He's the former superintendent of the Bertie County School District in North Carolina. And he sends me this like total cold call email and says, I'm a superintendent in Eastern North Carolina. I saw something published about your learning landscapes on Tree Hugger. And I was like, wow, a superintendent that reads Tree Hugger. Like that's the kind of person I want to work with. And he turned out to be this wonderful kindred spirit that just in a couple conversations, we really got the sense that he was unique in his belief that design had a place and an opportunity within a very, very broken school district. And so he invited us down to this elusive place called Bertie County in area code 252 that I had never heard of, 2.5 hours outside of Raleigh. And I don't know if many of you are from North Carolina or know the geography, but it's pretty polarized. I mean, you have the triangle and you have Charlotte, and then you have beautiful mountains on the western side, and then the whole eastern part of the state is basically a black hole. It's really resource poor. It's the home of, you know, industrial chicken farming and tobacco and cotton farming. Very racially divided, very rural. The county that we live in, Bertie, is about 25 people per square mile. Just every idea that you probably have about the Deep South is very much present in Bertie County. This being said, you know, we saw a lot of opportunity in this place that, coming from a place like San Francisco, like, we couldn't find a more opposite place. But in that contrast, there was such a wonderful chance for us to do things in a creative vacuum where we could measure the impact independently from so many other forces or things going on. Okay, just a couple other things to paint the picture for you here. So the county seat is Windsor. It's a town of almost 2,000 people. That's where we live. And it's kind of the same story that you hear about small town USA, Main Street. Almost all the buildings downtown are empty. There's no bookstore, no coffee shop, no movie theater, no Walmart in the whole county. Not a lot going on. And then on the sort of socioeconomic side, about 35% of children are living in poverty. And this is down the street from the public baseball fields, which were white only until 1997. So this is, we live like a block from here. This is the context in which we've decided to really dig in our heels and explore just how far we can push this type of design. So with Dr. Zollinger, you know, this began as the cold call email. He invited us to come down and to build these learning landscapes, one at each of the elementary schools. And so we flew down there, and he goes, okay, you have 4 days and a backhoe, and I hope that's enough. So we get down there, and we build these four playgrounds in 4 days. They were a big hit with the students and the teachers, and we figured, like, okay, we've worked with this great guy, and it was wonderful to meet you, and please stay in touch, and hopefully there are other opportunities. He had other plans. He had probably 15 other projects that he wanted us to stay and work on. So the first of these other projects is he gave me his credit card and said, redo 3 computer labs for us. Here's your budget. You have to also buy technology. Ready, set, go. So we redid these computer labs. At the time of this renovation, the passing rate for the state standard in both reading and math for 3rd through 8th graders was 26%. And so because of that passing rate, the school district had said, you know, in order to raise these passing rates, we're going to have biweekly benchmark testing. These kids spent way too much time in computer labs doing these benchmark tests, and the computer labs didn't look like this. They looked like hospital waiting rooms. I mean, totally clinical. You have concrete block wall. You come in, you're facing the concrete block wall to take your test, and you get up and leave. And there's no real opportunity for it to be a true learning space. So we sort of we took a spin on that and said, you know, this needs to be a learning space. It needs to be a testing facility, but it can also be engaging and collaborative and a place that kids actually want to be in. So we built these sort of tree trunk scenarios where we ran all the electricity and the Ethernet down through these cores and then fanned them out to the desks, which created a much more open and safe space, free of rats' nests of wires and such. And then a second scheme that we did, this was more optimized for instruction. All the kids were facing a very distinct front of the classroom, but similarly, all the electricity and cables ran through that chase along the wall and then out to the desktops. So we did these, and I gave Dr. Z his credit card back, and then he said, oh, well, while you're at it, we need to do a countywide campaign for a free broadband program. And he had found some money to put a desktop computer and a broadband internet connection in every household that had a student in the public school district, which was phenomenal for a place like this, which beforehand only had about 10% of families with access, not even with a connection, just with the ability to get internet if they wanted it. Before this, there was Bojangles. The chicken joint was like the only place you could get Wi-Fi. So I spent many a late night squatting in their parking lot. We had done these couple projects and a few more that I didn't show, a weight room for the football team and some others that weren't quite as glamorous. Matt's also trained as an architect, and we both felt that this was a really exciting space to work in, that we had stumbled upon this weird gray area between design and public education and the way that the two spoke to each other and the way they overlapped in this like Venn diagram in our heads was really, really interesting. However, all of these projects, we were still serving in the same type of design scenario where we have a client, we're designing something and implementing it. And we felt like if we really wanted to start to talk about and understand the intersection of design and education, we had to become teachers and be in the classroom with students and not just be delivering design, but using it as a more engaging platform for kids to be learning as well. So this all sounded really good in our heads. We're like, oh, we've both taught at a college level. Like, how different is teaching high school in the Deep South? So it turns out it's very different. And as I'm sure all of you probably would have known. But we ended up taking this idea of design build, which if any of you are familiar with some of the architecture schools, the universities that have programs like this, Rural Studio being one out of Auburn in Alabama. This model exists. It's a model where students, usually undergrad or graduate students, will be in a community, design, and then construct with their own hands a project for the community. What we wanted to do, though, was to bring that to a high school public education curriculum, which had never been done before. But the model as a design model works really, really well. So we thought, you know, instead of having to import design students from NC State or a university nearby, like, why can't we teach 16-year-olds how to be designers, how to be leaders, and how to work on a construction site, and how to weld, and how to build all these vocational skills that have lost so much funding in recent years. Okay, so we wrote this curriculum. We called it Studio H, and that was those first three words that you saw, design, build, transform. That was our initial curricular statement, that we wanted to teach those three things. Design as creative problem solving, building as like physical hands-on, industry relevant skills, and transformation in that all of the projects we wanted to do with our students should be visible, executed, architectural in scale, and for community benefit. So as we're sitting down to write this curriculum, you know, we had gotten to know a bunch of the students by this time. We'd worked with some of the teachers, met with some of the parents, and we kept hearing these four words come up over and over and over again: citizenship, creativity, capital, and critical thinking. And so we realized that these are four things that our students really need in order to be successful as young adults, and things that they're not getting from the traditional core subject classes. But these are also four things that this place, that Bertie County, needs in order to survive and in order to like stay alive as an economy and as a community. So we wanted this Studio H curriculum to really speak to both. At the same time as we're developing this curriculum, I was doing some grant writing, and everything just came together really beautifully to where we could start teaching in the fall of 2010 with grant funding for a full-scale architectural project, 13 students every single day for 3 hours a day for two semesters, and then a summer following the school year where we would be on a job site building this project that we had spent the year designing with our students. And through some like bureaucratic mechanics here. So we had to run it through a community college, and in doing so, we were able to offer our students 17 transferable college credits, high school elective credit, and then also the paid summer job. So if nothing else, even if our students were not into design or vocational education or whatever, they saw those college credits and they saw the summer job as a huge attraction. And we knew we were going to have to provide incentive and value beyond just the rhetoric around what the curriculum was. Okay, so I should also say that 4 weeks before the school year started, Dr. Zollinger was fired and run out of town. That is also a whole other lecture, but the short version of the story is that there was a lot of political, a little bit racially motivated bickering amongst the school board, and he was run out of town, asked to leave very suddenly, very aggressively, and everything that he had started, touched, believed in, was on the chopping block as well, us being at the top of the list. So this is 4 weeks before school starts. I have grant funding. We know our students. We have, you know, our class list. We have our space. We took over this old auto body shop barn behind the high school, and we actually didn't really ask. We just broke in and renovated it and decided it was going to be our classroom. Yeah, so this is 4 weeks out, and we're like, okay, great, what do we do? We had two salaries promised to us by the superintendent that we don't have anymore. So are we going to teach this for free, or are we going to go? We ended up, that was why we went to the community college, to ask if we could at least be hired as adjunct faculty to run this through the community college, and in doing so, provide college credit. So this is a little 11th-hour shakeup and one of many challenges that would continue for years, and really left us in the wake of a lot of political upheaval with the school board, who continue to not support us solely because of our association with the former superintendent. So anyway, we decided to dig in our heels and do this basically for free. I mean, we had the space, we had the students, and we wanted to prove that this model was worth something, that we had an idea that the students would grab hold of and really be able to produce something wonderful for the community. So the first day rolls around, and you know, Matt and I both realize that we have no idea what to do with a classroom full of teenagers. And also we realize that we are looking at some serious remediation, that we have students who are reading at a fifth or sixth grade level. We have students who have never had an art or PE class. Some of them were taking PE online, actually, which makes no sense to me. But there was just a lack of fluency. We couldn't talk about design until we could, you know, have students that knew how to read rulers, for example. So we really had to go back and, like, build in all of these remediation tactics. We became math teachers and English teachers and social studies teachers and assigning New York Times articles so that we could talk about local issues, and it became so much more than just this design studio that we envisioned in our heads. So we started, this was one of our first design-related exercises. We discovered that a green bell pepper is a wonderful object to teach plan, section, and elevation, which are the basic architectural drawings. So you can slice it and talk about section. You can set it on its side and draw the elevation. And then the basics of color theory. For students that had never seen a color wheel or had never learned what primary colors were, and why is that even important, and why should we talk about it, and how is that going to help us when it comes time to design a communication campaign, for example. And then in the wood shop, how to read a ruler, first and foremost, and how to understand which materials you might use, and how to lay them out and measure them and draw them at an architectural scale, set up a shop drawing, etc. So the first project, we had to start with something small, given all the limitations here. So if any of you know the game Cornhole, like, or maybe you call it Bags. Okay, so it's like a carnival style beanbag toss game, with two boards, and they have holes in them, and you try to get the beanbag in the hole. It's very dumb and very addicting. So we decided, it's huge in Bertie County. So we decided, like, oh, the cornhole board would be a perfect object that they would have to build, design a graphic for, and produce, like, precisely and with their own individual concept. So, you know, in the wood shop, they have to build these things. They have to dial in the dimensions, because if you're off by an eighth of an inch, it's not going to stand upright. So this is a lesson in taking pride and care and being thoughtful and precise about your own work. And then on the graphic design side, oh, the color's a little bad on this image. There's this wonderful list of action verbs that was written by Richard Serra a couple decades ago. And there are things like to rotate, to hinge, to twist, to fold, to crease. Kind of abstract as graphic concepts, but for our students, it was a way to say, no, you cannot put a John Deere logo on the cornhole board. You can do something that's more interesting and speaks to and shows some kind of conceptual development. So we gave them the two colors of the beanbags for their set. That became their color palette. And then they each had a word. I think this one was to hinge. So they had to figure out in their mind, like, what is to hinge look like in two dimensions? And how can I fold these colors into that concept? And then, as I said, industry-relevant skills of production. So this is Adobe Illustrator. They had to take this abstract sketch concept and turn it into a full-scale, printable, accurate drawing that they could execute. We used this really precise taping method that got super annoying, and it was a lesson in patience for all of us. But again, like the importance of precision and taking pride in producing something that you designed. So here are some of the final boards. This is to weave and to stretch on the right, and then to twist and to fold. And then here are some of the other ones. So again, you know, this project wasn't necessarily for community benefit so much as just to get them to a point of fluency where we could say, okay, now let's talk about architecture and let's talk about community and the social implications of the things that we build. We did, however, have a cornhole showdown, and we invited all the families to come out, and we auctioned off the boards to help fund our next project, which were small-scale chicken coops. So I'm sure many of you have seen Food Inc., and I'm also pretty sure that some of the chicken farmers interviewed in that film were from Bertie or the surrounding areas. Purdue, the chicken processing plant, is the biggest employer in the county. This is what our students know of chicken farming. One of our students has 250,000 chickens on his family's farm at any given time. They come in and out on a 6-week cycle. And he's the guy who at 5 a.m. goes in with the giant vacuum cleaner and sucks up the dead ones. Like, this is, that's also another lecture, but this is what's familiar when you say chicken. This is what our students know. So without going into the whole critique about industrial scale farming, and we wanted to say to the students, okay, so this is what's familiar. That's probably not going to change. But what would it look like if we talked about chickens in a different way? So instead of having 250,000 chickens, what if you have 6 in your backyard, egg-laying hens as a source of sustainable food? So just a twist on something that was already familiar. So in order to do this, you know, we figured if we're going to design chicken coops, we have to get to know our client. So we brought chickens into our classroom. This coop is not at all an example of good design. It is an example of finding a semi-truck hood in the forest and dragging it out and slapping together a chicken coop in 4 hours so that we could have chickens in our classroom. So this is Henrietta and Jezebel. They were our clients. And this, you know, my students thought I was crazy, but we sat there for 2 days and watched them. And we learned about how, and a lot of this I didn't know. I had never spent that much intense time with chickens, but, you know, we learned how they like to feed. They don't want to eat out of a trough. They would much prefer to peck. And they actually don't need a lot of space to roost. They like to huddle together and be confined when roosting. And so there are all these things that we learned that would help our students make decisions about the design of this piece of chicken architecture. So this is also their first attempt at form making, right? They've done these cornhole boards, but never something three-dimensional from scratch. So we used a process called sketch modeling, where you're building a model, tearing it apart, building 50 more, combining two, tearing that apart. It's a very non-linear process. So I'm just going to show you. We ended up building 3. They each had an individual concept, and then we ended up combining a couple of them, and we ended up with 3 really solid concepts that we built. So the first one, this came from a really simple sketch of this, like, skewed pentagon. And we saw it in one of our students' notebooks one day and said, That's a really interesting form. How can you push that? And how can you fold in all of the requirements of the design brief, the square footage for roosting and food and water and all that? So we built, actually, so the version on the right is close to what we ended up building. Pallet wood siding. I don't know if any of you have tried to take apart a pallet, but it is messy, messy work, and you end up with far too many splinters. But our students, they chose to use pallets. We gave them a $500 budget, and they went and fished out all these pallets from God knows where and came in and said, well, you know, we have free material, so if we come in under budget, like, you're going to let us keep whatever money we don't spend, right? I'm like, well, no, but I have to applaud you for being creative. So they use this as the siding. And then, their first adventures in MIG welding. This is, the structural frame. And then a very simple sort of corrugated roof. And then there were two swinging doors that they built in, so that the top one, that was access for the person tending to the chickens to go and collect eggs. And then on the bottom, that's where you could access the food and water area and then the, run space off of the front. So this one was given to a family that lives across the street from the school, the Parker family. And, oh, what did they name this one? This was a chicken circus, was the name of the coop. The second one was a very sort of literal interpretation of the design brief, where this team saw, okay, we need space for food and water, and we need space for roosting. That's two boxes of space, and how can we put those two boxes together in an interesting way? So they came up with this really cool model, and they were trying to get it to stand up the way that you see it here, with one at ground level and then one kind of like a split-level chicken coop. So as they're trying to get this thing to stand up, like 3 seconds after I took this photo, it fell over, and it was resting on its corners of those cubes. And they looked at it and went, oh, well, that's actually way cooler. Let's just build it like that. And it was this kind of wonderful moment, like, where that kind of accident, they could have been like, oh, no, that's just wrong. But they looked at it and stopped for a sec and actually saw an opportunity to do something, I think, more interesting. Very simple construction for this. It was a wood frame. Again, a little bit of MIG welding for the twisted run between the two. And then we sheathed the run. One of our students came in with like hundreds, 300-400 of these tobacco sticks, that they use in the tobacco barns to dry the long strands of tobacco. That he said he was given by a tobacco farmer, but I have a feeling it was more of a covert op. But so we stained all of these in the same stain as the boxes. And then this was given to the Byram family, who live right across the street from the Parkers, coincidentally. So where the school is, though, it's on this rural route, and you drive for like 20 miles and there's nothing for 20 miles. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's like two crazy coops on either side of the road. And then a quarter of a mile later, the school. But it's just funny that of all the places in the county, they ended up across the street from each other. And then the third one was our Buckminster Fuller inspired coop. At the beginning of this design process, we gave them each an architectural precedent. So a piece of architecture that we believe to have, some sort of lesson they could take away, whether it was an interesting use of materials, or it was cited within the context really interestingly, or the circulation or the ventilation or whatever. There was something really interesting about it. And so the student that designed this coop had Buckminster Fuller, the Demaxian house, and also the geodesic dome. And he was so enchanted by this idea that you could take really simple geometries and make them into something really complex. So he did, this is four of probably 60 models that he did, starting with a flat piece of cardboard and then cutting and scoring them in interesting ways and then twisting them up into these three-dimensional, maybe coupes or maybe just like really cool shapes. He didn't know at the time and he didn't need to. But eventually he ended up with this model that he brought to us and said, okay, I'm ready to build this. And having watched the chickens, I know that what they really want is run space, and they can peck out of the run space. And so this is like 90% run space, and then a little roosting box over on the left side. And so Matt and I, you know, we look at this and we're like, that's a really awesome coop, but we have no idea how to build it. The other two were very self-explanatory in going from the design to the construction, and this one was not. Because he had built this out of one flat piece of chipboard, and we wanted the construction to mimic that. So how do you mimic something in structural plywood that has been modeled in chipboards? This was a pretty wonderful, messy process of prototyping for our students, of failing miserably, having to go back and fix it and try it again. And this was like 6 or 7 rounds of prototyping this hinge of how could we get this thing to be structurally sound. Eventually, we figured out this hinge. We replicated the long strip in plywood and sheet metal. And then we had a raise the roof day and had to pick this thing up. This took like 2.5 hours. The whole class had to pick this thing up, and we're looking across the room at the model and going, okay, I guess it sort of looks like that. Like, you need to pull that side down. You need to push this side up. Quick, let's, you know, affix this to the wall, or give me a 2x4 so it doesn't fall on our heads. Total trial and error, but like, this is the kind of process that I think really excites our students, that design specifically can offer, because it is so, there's immediate feedback and there's physical engagement, and eventually it started to look like the model. And then, you know, back to the welding shop, we did a structural frame. And then we used this rubberized roof paint to waterproof it. And then this was the final coupe, which they named Coupus Maximus in honor of Bucky Fuller. And then this was the team that built it, Eric, Alexia, Karan, and Cameron. Okay, so I have a quick little video clip of our chicken coop process here.
I think we have a lot of work to do, and we can get a lot accomplished today. All right, let's get to work. This is not just a piece of plywood or sheet metal. This is chicken coop that myself and Karan designed.
It definitely doesn't feel like homework. I definitely feel like we're actually working to work and build something.
Well, here's my favorite part.
This is a perfect example of disobedience. Make sure you get this on camera.
This is like the make or break. They need to start looking like coops, like by the end of the day.
It's amazing.
I think the chickens are gonna love it because they have a giant run space.
Can have an ownership and a say in your own education. That, I think, is something that design offers. Okay. Oh, we weren't supposed to see that slide yet. So that was a really fun project, and this slide, as Diana mentioned, there were 2 devastating floods and an F4 tornado within 10 months in Bertie County. So the chicken coop project happened during the first flood, and then when we had finished that project, there was a second flood, and this is downtown Windsor that was completely underwater. I took this photo after the water had fallen when I could get back into downtown. So coming off of this really wonderful chicken coop project, we're faced with this countywide disaster, and at the same time had to start thinking about, okay, what are we going to build at a full architectural scale for our hometown? So it was a really bittersweet moment for our students to be involved in some of these town discussions. I mean, we were at the town hall meetings, we were at the Rotary Club meetings, our students got to speak to the mayor, and it was like I said, it was bittersweet. We wanted to help build back, but we also wanted to contribute something and build back better. So what is that? What do we build in a time where this is the context? So in talking to some of the town councilmen and our students, who a lot of them come from farming families, we kept hearing from a lot of different sources that there's no farmer's market within about an 80-mile radius. Very, very high obesity rates, an agricultural economy, and there's no farmer's market. And so, you know, in a place like Austin or Portland or San Francisco, the farmer's market is on every corner and is, you know, we sort of expect there to be access to farmer's markets. And in Bertie County, it was a really revolutionary idea. And so what a wonderful thing for us to be able to contribute. The town said, okay, you want to build a farmer's market? Here's a piece of land. Go for it. And we will manage it once it's up and running. There was not only no building, but there was no enterprise. We had to start the market as an enterprise and go and find vendors to sell. This wasn't a field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. We had to literally build up this thing from an architectural and a business perspective as well. But our students love this idea. I mean, many of them do come from farming families. They love the idea of just having something downtown, like where they could go on a Saturday and hang out or bring their families or anything. So similar to the chicken coops, you know, we went straight back to the studio and we went through a similar process of sketch modeling. And I think in our heads, you know, you hear the word farmer's market and you probably have a preconceived notion of what a farmer's market looks like. We went to the state farmer's market in Raleigh and always with a critical eye, though. Like, farmers markets are generally not very inspiring architectural pieces of whatever, or they're not architectural at all. It's a stretch of curb where people set up card tables. So we wanted this to say something about not just here's a farmers market, but here's what a farmers market can be, and here's what a farmers market can do for our hometown. So we did some initial sketches and did this public exhibition downtown and invited all of the town councilmen and the families and everyone to just be involved in this conversation. This is one of the town councilmen and my student, Karan, who I am almost 100% sure if we hadn't had this exhibition, these two people never would have met, let alone talk to each other, about something that they both really, really believed in. So I love that we were able to put these people in the same room around something progressive. And then based on all this feedback, you know, we had 13 students, 13 ideas, but we need one solid idea that we can go to the construction site with. So, you know, we had to go back to really dialing in, like, what's our budget? What kind of materials can we get within a 100-mile radius? We wanted to source everything locally. What are we physically capable of building based on the fact that our students have spent maybe 15 hours welding, have had minimal masonry training? Like, what can we physically pull off? And Project H is a general contractor, but we aren't great with electrical. So what can we do that's going to be fairly self-sufficient, that doesn't need a lot of plumbing, that doesn't need crazy electrical systems? This was really where, you know, the design concepts and all of the blue sky great ideas had to be put through a lot of very real-world filters. So all of the students had to present to a panel of architects that came in from Raleigh and helped us think through what was feasible here. And ultimately, we came up, this was actually the kid with the 250,000 chickens. This came from an initial concept that he did and was very much inspired by some of the local architecture of these peanut trailer sheds where they pull in, there's 8 bays, they pull in these peanut trailers, and they're really simple structures, but they're very vernacular, they're everywhere, and so we use the term vernacular sublime. We wanted this thing to be familiar and approachable, but like really, really cool. And we could physically pull this off with a construction crew of teenagers, which is a liability nightmare. So the last day of school rolls around and we have all of our permits and we have all of our equipment and everything ready to go. And our students are like, yeah, it's the summer. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'll see you on Monday. We have 2,000 square feet of farmer's market to build. So we literally, like, the day after school got out, we're on this construction site. It's 110 degrees outside. And we started digging. I made them dig for, like, 6 days straight, which none of them liked. I didn't particularly like either. Dug this foundation, prefabricated these trusses in our shop, and then disassembled them and took them to the site, reassembled them, had our friend Boyd Copeland bring a lot of very crazy machinery to help hoist these things up. And then, you know, back to basic carpentry. This was like flashback to cornhole boards. Like, we had to custom fit every single one of these floor joists, and it had to be down to a very specific tolerance. So, you know, all the things that they learned in the classroom were really important on the job site as well. Oh, this is a week before Hurricane Irene. So we had just put up the bracing, and the hurricane was coming. We were like, oh, maybe we should put up more bracing. But we worked with a structural engineer, and it ended up being perfectly fine. But it was a great, like, little teaching moment where we had to go back and look at the drawings and talk about physics with our students on a job site. And they're like, oh, this is like school. Like, well, do you want this thing to stand up when Irene comes through? So again, like, back to just applying core subjects to things that are very, very real. And then putting up the siding. And then this is the finished building, part of the reason we wanted to do something architectural and something really honest and, like, dirty and real was that we had to start this farmer's market. And over the summer, there were people going to the temporary location of the farmer's market, which was adjacent to the construction site. And every weekend, they got to see this thing start as 24 holes in the ground, coming up out of the ground, and then eventually becoming this thing that they would then inhabit as farmers or as people wanting fresh produce or whatever. It was a spectacle. There was an element of like watching this visible progress happen every weekend. So we had this opening ceremony. We invited the whole town, all the families, the mayor, the town councilman, the school board. Of course, they didn't come. But it was like this just wonderful moment of closure and celebration for our students. This is 12 months of blood, sweat, and tears, literally all three, more than for us. I think for our students, it was a validation that their ideas matter, and that their ideas are, not only do they matter, but, like, this was the most amazing thing to happen to this town, and they were the ones that made it happen. It was also really cool to see, some of the design decisions that they had been so deliberate in making being used exactly as they had been designed for. So here you can see all of the vendors have a designated parking spot behind their bay, and so they can open up their trunk or their truck bed and load directly into their bay. And this was something that our students realized we had to build 3 feet above base flood elevation level, because we're in a floodplain and a hurricane zone. And we were like, oh, that's a bummer. Like, who wants to have a deck up here? And then our students realized, well, you can actually use it as a loading dock, and that's a really great design element. And so this is, you know, this is all them, like, coming to these conclusions and then seeing them used in that way. And then same with, you know, the vendors, just getting to see the vendors using this thing that was a sketch in their sketchbook not that long ago. So our students were there, obviously, and the mayor gave them the key to the city at the opening ceremony, and he goes, this is the second key to the city we've ever given out in 100 years. And he hands them the key, and he's like, it's also a bottle opener. I'm like, don't say that to them. They're 17. But anyway, so I don't know what they were more excited about, the key or the bottle opener. But just like such a wonderful moment to cap off this crazy, challenging, intense, tiring, and wonderful year. And then this is just a final shot of the building the night after the opening ceremony. So that's basically the story. And I just want to wrap this all up and go back to these three words, because I feel a little bit like a black sheep, especially in this crowd, because I do really believe in the value of simple and appropriate technologies that have the ability to engage and inspire people because they can be invested in their own environments in a very real way. And so we started with these three words when we went to write the curriculum. They obviously mean a lot in our classroom, but I think that beyond just our classroom and even beyond just our organization, I think that no matter what your role is or what your profession is, that these are things we can all strive for, that we obviously need to value creativity more as an asset and as a resource, and we need to be able to execute those ideas and not just take them to a conceptual level and walk away. And transformation is kind of the home run. That's the punchline for me, that anything that we're doing, whether it's design, construction, whatever it is, I mean, we should always be thinking about the social bottom line and what we're able to contribute and how we can measure that and grow, those opportunities for everyone involved, whether it's a 16-year-old, or a client or coworkers, that should be a part of our professional culture. Thank you very much. Thanks. Thanks. Okay, so I have 8 minutes, and I guess we could take a couple of questions if there are any. And if not, I will be sitting at a table with my books in 15, so you can also go ahead. Oh, there's a mic here, which I think they want to use. Or we can pass around, maybe. Thanks. Hi. Sorry, one sec.
Mic check. 1, 2. Oh. My name is Tariq. I live in Milwaukee. I used to practice architecture for over 10 years, graduate Howard University. I decided to go into public radio, but I have no idea how that happened. Question is, I know, have these kids gone to college? If so, are they going to architecture school?
Good question. So I should preface that by saying it was never our goal to train the next generation of architects, especially now that New York Times article came out and was like the highest unemployment rates are in architecture. But no, that was never really the goal. I think more so we wanted to just give students possibilities, whether they want to stay in the county and get a job as a welder. Great, you're going to be a better welder. Some of them are going into engineering now because of certain things that they've picked up. But, you know, I have a student who wants to be an OBGYN, and the thing that she hopefully took away was how to communicate better. The students from this year are now seniors. They'll be going to college in the fall. And I wrote like 10 rec letters. But they're going to college, and most of them are first-generation college goers, and some of them, like I said, are engineering. But the student with all the chickens who designed the initial concept, is going to school for agriculture now. So I would love it if one of them went into architecture, but I also think that, you know, we had to view this as a broad opportunity, that they could each take something away from no matter what they were interested in, or that we could help them find what those interests were.
Hi, my name is Daniel. I'm with the University of Alabama in Huntsville. And the location that you're talking about is almost identical to where I'm from in Franklin County, Alabama, where it's just not very many people near there. You touched briefly on the idea of getting broadband access to rural areas, like, you know, there and also in Alabama. What's the answer to that? Because the telecom companies don't want to spend money to get access to, honestly, low-income people.
Right.
So, for something like this to happen, it seems to me as if students have to be able to access the web reliably in order to find and share ideas. How do we get broadband to rural areas like this?
I have no idea. I mean, I think you're right. You're partially right. I don't think it's a cure-all. I mean, I think you have to teach a student how to want to ask questions before they're going to go get online to find the answers. So in a lot of situations, I've found that, like, for example, the school board was offered a bunch of iPads to give to the high school seniors, but no one knows how to use them. No one knows how to teach with them. And so there's like a black market for iPads now. So my point is, I mean, I think that it is important. And if for nothing else, as a social justice issue, there, you should have access to internet in these places. But I don't think that is necessarily a cure-all. The schools do have internet, and so there is an opportunity to use it within the educational system. I don't know the answer. I really don't, because I've seen some of the families that have recently gotten online, and I don't think they're using them for the things that they're using the internet for the things that you're suggesting, which is why I think in the classroom that's our opportunity to teach. This is what the internet's for, and this is how we can use it, but more than anything, to ask the right questions. Because if you ask the right questions, you'll be able to find the answers. But I think we have to take a step back from that as a solution and ask, you know, what are we instilling in our students to get them to think in the most inquisitive ways before we're giving them these tools that they may or may not know how to use? That was a not so great answer. I don't know the answer, but I just think we have to be cautious about parachuting those solutions into places that don't have the bigger systems to support it yet.
Thank you for this great presentation. I was wondering if you could talk to what's next, like what's in the future. Are you working on replicating this program, or others working on replicating it?
Yeah, I always get that question, and I always have a different answer. We're in a really weird moment with this school district, because to be totally honest, we do not have the support that we need in order to really be sustainable in this place. I mean, so far we've funded every single piece of lumber. Our salaries were $700 a month from the community college. And this is all because of the resistance from the school board. And so at a certain point, we're going to have to really look at, do we stay? Do we leave? If we leave, what do we leave behind? And to answer your question about replication, I think that is part of the answer, that this year in particular, we're trying to be a lot more deliberate about how we're packaging things like lesson plans or the pedagogy or the process around design thinking, and which pieces of this are transferable and which are not. Because I don't think, obviously, I couldn't hand someone the lesson plan for the chicken coops in, you know, downtown Baltimore or whatever. Or some of it is very contextually responsive, and I think that is the thing that is transferable, is teaching in a contextually responsive way. But as far as how we package that and replicate it, I don't know yet. I don't. I think that we have to put in all of our due diligence to figure out if we can even sustain it in this place. And if we end up leaving, that will be our opportunity to figure out, okay, well, if we are moving, how are we doing it in this new context, and how is that transition going to be replicable for other schools? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Tamara, and I work at Teach for America, and I just want to compliment you and praise you on how inspiring this is and how amazing it is to see kids actually creating dramatic change in their neighborhoods. It's, awe-inspiring. But I want you to talk a little bit about, if you would, the initial investment and process of getting kids, because you spoke a bit about remediation, which speaks to my experiences in the classroom as well, but your process of investing kids in what they were doing and making them see possibilities and just all that initial work that it must have taken to get to this point where you are.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. And actually, Teach for America, to be honest, they're some of the only teachers in Bertie that will work with us. So thank you for that. But there was just so much legwork we didn't anticipate. I should say, though, that the students that we had this year were the entire junior class from this particular track in the high school. So they were forced to be in our program. They were, it wasn't an elective. It is this year, but last year they were the whole class. And so there was a lot of, I think, resistance just because of that. Purely just a reaction to being forced into something they didn't have a say in. But no, as far as the core subjects and having to do that kind of remediation, we were surprised we had to do it, but in having to go through it, I think we realized we should have done this in the first place, that the more we can teach every subject through what we do, the better off we're all going to be. That being said, many of the teachers, except for the Teach for America teachers, don't want anything to do with us because we're the crazy people in the barn. And, you know, we get blamed when we have our students in the morning and they're all amped up, and then they go to history and they're still amped up, and the history teacher has to deal with it. And I'll get phone calls like, why is Cameron, you know, jumping out of his chair? Like, why can't you teach normally? And I'm like, well, so a lot of it, I think, is just cultural between working with other teachers. But I would love to spend more time trying to evolve our curriculum to be more, not necessarily remedial, but just to embrace every single subject as much as we can. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. I'm going to come find you later.
Okay.
Thanks. So now I feel a little awkward because both of my questions just got answered.
Oh.
So, but I did want to say, my name is Natalie Taylor and my family is from, Bertie County. And
no way.
So I just,
Where in Bertie?
Winston Lane in Windsor.
Oh my gosh.
So I just wanted to say thank you.
Three blocks from there.
Sorry.
No, it's so nice to, we have to talk later too.
Yeah. For everything that you're doing.
Thank you. That means so much. Oh. I'm going to start crying.
thanks so much for the presentation. My question is, have you thought about using rapid prototyping or other types of sort of rapid fabrication as a part of your classwork in the future?
Oh, I'm really glad you asked that, and that's a good question to end on. So the first year we didn't. That was also a result of what we could afford to buy. We had to buy every tool in our studio. So we bought the basics. This second year, though, we had a laser cutter donated to us, and which was like the best Christmas gift anyone could ever get. And so we've been doing a lot more rapid prototyping, but only as sort of an extension of, you know, first let's use the table saw, and then let's use the laser cutter, which essentially are doing the same things, right? So we try to talk about technology as a lineage, as like going from the table saw to the laser cutter and when we would need to use both. So we are starting to embrace some more of those technologies, especially like with the cornhole boards. The first year they had to do all that by hand with the tape. The second year we just covered the whole board in tape and set it on the laser cutter and printed the file and then peeled off the tape, and we didn't have to exacto cut anything. So there's a lot of instances where it makes a ton of sense. But we do ask our students to think through, like, which tool they're going to use and why. Because we can't just be like, oh, I don't want to make a model out of cardboard. I want to just laser cut it. Like, you also have to know how to make a model out of cardboard. So we try to go back and forth between the two. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, thank you guys so much. Thanks.